discovering stories of people living out their beliefs in our culture, communities, and the public square, and finding courage, determination, and hope. Welcome to Faith Radio's On the Road. Now, here's Ryan Thomas.
Well, as we look to the beauty of an impossibly blue sky, we take in the might of the ocean, and we consider the majesty of a mountain peak. The most sensible question seems to be, how did this all get here? And even more so when we think of the stunning complexity of the human body, from the eye to the cell to DNA, how did this all come to pass? But beyond that, why does it matter where we come from? Well, nearly a century after the Scopes trial, the debate between those advocating a completely natural, unassisted, and Darwinian explanation for our origins and those advancing a form of creation or a creator or a designer is still as fiery as it has ever been. And the debate has been rekindled from the perspective of those advancing a fresh theory of intelligent design. And today we go on the road to the proverbial horse's mouth. A man who studies and teaches the sciences is a friend of mine, I'm glad to say. If he claims it, we'll see. And one of the smartest people I have ever had the pleasure of experiencing in real life. Dr. Bruce Simad is here with us on the road today. He's an associate professor of biology at University of Northwestern St. Paul. He has specialties that run the gamut, but immunology, general biology, and physiology. The man does a great deal of research, and he's fun to listen to as well. I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Bruce Simad. Sir, thank you for being with us today. It is a pleasure to be in the same room as you once again.
Well, that's remarkable what you just said. I hope to live up to 10% of your opinions. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sir, as we begin this conversation, I mean, the basic question really is, why is it important where we came from and how we got here?
It's so important in that it sets the tone of who we are. I think that when we do not have a sense of who we are or whose we are, if we don't belong to God, we are left adrift. We are left adrift to our own devices, to our own definitions of who we are. And then we start to define ourselves by, gee, the job I do, gee, the money I make, gee, the people I know, gee, how I fit into society. We get tossed and turned upside down by wondering who we are and why we're even here. It then also begs the question, do I need to continue to be here? Why am I still alive? Gee, now we have problems with suicide because there's no hope. There's no reason why of our existence. So the origins, the whole concept of was I created? Was I put here under the workmanship of God, or did I come from a rock? You know, essentially the elements, and therefore I am a quote from quoting one of the biology books, just a cosmic accident.
Intelligent design really seems to have refreshed this debate. Of course, it's been ongoing for so many years and decades. But tell us a bit more, Doctor, about the intelligent design movement. Now, this is not just the faith-based community, is it? I mean, we're talking about folks who have come together in a way across some ideological spectrums.
Oh, that's true. There are atheists in the intelligent design community, and there are evangelical Christians, and everywhere in between. They have all, however, come to the conclusion that life is far too complex and far too regulated and perfect to have come from essentially rock, essentially the elements, to be organized that way. So, and it's that obvious. Everybody knows that, but those who have decided that it still must be just a natural process of self-organization of elements that don't actually, under any kind of circumstances, self-organize, they still believe that. That's purely philosophical. So these folks in intelligent design have been able to rid themselves and resist the naturalism philosophy and look at the data objectively and find that, in fact, there is a design, and it's far beyond any of our intelligence. So it must be a higher intelligence that puts a simple cell, even a bacteria cell, far above the elements as they are.
Can you tell me a bit about the concept of irreducible complexity? Because this fascinates me. Mm-hmm. Basically, as I understand it, this is one of the things most discussed by intelligent designers, because you're talking about things that are simply so massively complex that they simply could not have come from nowhere and just sort of appeared and come into existence.
That's a very good point. The irreducible complexity concept is that you have to have the entire system in place for it to function. You cannot have a subset of it or anything simpler than all of it. So that begs the question, how did it develop? If it's totally dysfunctional, non-functional in anything less than all of it, then how did it evolve from nothing and be dysfunctional, non-functional, but keep moving toward a final end result where all of it is there, and now all of a sudden, miraculously, it's functional? So this goes with every system, not just when we look at the whole cell and say that's the whole cell has to be there. We look at all the subsets within the cell, all the organelles, the little organs inside of a cell. Everything has to be perfect. All of it has to be there for it to be functional. So the whole concept or the theory of the nothing becoming everything in perfection has no lineage. It cannot be something less, something less, something less, something less, all the way back to elements. It all has to be organized perfectly in total. So intelligent design theorists are able to promote this and show this because all the data is there for that. It's not something we have to try to show and prove. It is all there. What is not provable or showable is that there was any kind of progression from nothing to perfection of a cell.
And Dr. Bruce Simat is with us, Associate Professor of Biology at University of Northwestern, St. Paul. And we're talking about where we come from. We're talking about the concept of origins and especially focusing on the intelligent design theory. And it's so interesting because being interested in this topic for some time, you cannot help but come across publications and web articles that declare that ID is just rebaked creationism and that it's a pseudoscience. I was interested in that phrase, pseudoscience. What would you say to somebody, by the way, who would describe ID as pseudoscience, doctor?
Well, that's a philosophical person who does not want to let go of naturalism, that only nature can create from nothing. And in fact, when we say that, when someone says nature created it, we have no clue what we're saying, because what is nature? What are the forces of nature that could be creating, that would have creative power? We're clueless of what that could be. We know that protons are positively charged particles of an atom, and electrons are negatively charged, and they have an attraction to each other. And that's the end of that. Now, to have molecules being made from these atoms, they don't have an attraction to arrange themselves in any meaningful way. And now to have molecules becoming greater and greater complexes so that they are complex molecules, they have no attraction for each other. So nature, in its final analysis, does not have any power to arrange itself. So when they look at intelligent design and make comments that it's a pseudoscience, it's really in reverse. The idea of nature making anything is a pseudoscience. It is a philosophical non-science, which I would prefer to call it nonsense. Because when you look at nature and it does not have power to create, and you just say it did it somehow, that's not only philosophical, that is a religion. That is nothing more than a religion saying that nature, whatever that might be, is creative. Well, show me some data.
And the data is what I want to ask you about next, but we'll in just a moment return to the concept of philosophy, because there is seemingly it can be brooked no opposition to a wholly material explanation for origins. Any time that that's opposed, there's such a zeal with which folks are pushed back. But I'll ask you that in a second. First, this lack of transitional fossils, or, you know, the missing links, Dr. Simat, you know, it's interesting to me because ID continues to be attacked, as we just said, but this central theme of what would need to take place for really the whole philosophy of macroevolution from a completely natural standpoint would hinge then on these missing links, would it not? And have any ever been discovered?
That's an excellent question, and that is the point. The transitional fossils, as it's referred to, is always in the mind of the beholder. So you have to look at the entire fossil record. Number one is the entire fossil record. When you look at the entire picture, do we have any kind of clear-cut lineages where we could say that creature more complex and looking at this other creature so much less complex, could we find fossils that show a progressive change into the more complex? No, we cannot find those. We do not have lineages from simple to complex. They're missing. They're called the missing links. Well, they're everywhere. That is the predominant conclusion of paleontologists around the world, that there are all these missing links. And they're not just missing one here, one there. There is no lineage. So lines are drawn in the textbook connecting a simple fossil to a more complex, and by choice, not by lineage. So a book written by Walter Ramine from Minneapolis, published by St. Paul Science here in the Twin Cities, Walter Ramine wrote a book called The Biotic Message, and it's evolution versus message theory. And his premise in there about message theory is that when you look at all of the biology, all of the fossils, when you look at the entire record, it gives us a message, a clear message that everything looks like it was designed by one engineer, not multiple engineers. Evolution would say nature all around the earth was creating by its own devices multiple times, various places, and it would not look with the integrity of one design. And everything together has the exact same kind of complexity, the same kinds of checks and balances to keep it complex and keep it alive. So he wrote a very excellent book on that, and there's a particular chapter, his chapter 13, called The Fossil Record, and he quotes dozens and dozens of quotes from evolutionists who admit that that they do not have. Here's one. The absence of the fossil evidence for intermediary stages between major transitions in design, indeed our inability even in our imagination to construct functional intermediates in many cases, has been a persistent and nagging problem for the gradualistic accounts of Darwinian evolution. Right? That's typical. Darwinian evolution, gradual changes, is not in the fossil record.
Wow. That would seem to be a problem.
You would think so.
Dr. Bruce Simad here with us as we go on the road. You know, from the perspective of the scientific elite in academia, we see this pushback that can be so fierce. And one of the most well-known examples is detailed in the film No Intelligence Allowed from Ben Stein, where they take the perspectives of so many who've worked in academia and have even spoken a word about potentially saying, oh, intelligent design may be an explanation for some of the holes that we find here in the tale. But there is a pushback that is so zealous, and I just wonder, why can absolutely, positively, no opposition be brooked? In your view, from what you've seen, why can't they take any opposition?
In the discussions I've had with such individuals who are vehemently in favor of naturalism only, is that because it is a religion. If you cannot accept supernatural, then you are stuck with and you believe in and you must espouse naturalism. And that says there is only nature. Well, that's simply, and bottom line is that is a religion. That is a philosophical statement. There's only nature because I can only see nature. So that's all there is because I can only see that. And that's all there is. It just keeps a circular argument. So with that as the granite rock that upon which you base all of your observations, well, now everything you see has to be natural. It has to be. Well, if you give that up, then you have to start acquiescing to maybe there's something above nature. One particular atheistic evolutionist said, and I was reading his article, just because we can't find the fossil record, and and there are arguments against natural phenomena. The supernatural is not the only answer you could go to. There's any number of other explanations other than supernatural, just because we can't find a natural explanation. And then he offered no other explanation and didn't even hint to one. And I've never read any other explanation. It's either natural or it's supernatural. Nobody's come up with an in-between natural. It's kind of, no one has come up with anything. If they would, if they could, they would. So it ends up being a choice of your philosophy of life. Mm-hmm. I will, if I will not entertain supernatural, then I have to try to explain everything naturally, even if the data doesn't fit anywhere close. I'm still have to do it because my religion says so. My philosophy says so. So really, it is a matter of what glasses do you put on in the morning? You know, philosophical glasses. What are you wearing?
Yeah. Dr. Bruce Simmat is Associate Professor of Biology at University of Northwestern, St. Paul. And Doctor, of course, we want to let you go whenever you need to get going because you've got students to tend to and important educational material. But I do wonder, the debate in the schools. Now, I recall that you were involved with giving testimony down in Kansas, I believe, over the issue of what would be taught as a theory of origins in the schools. Is there any window or ray of light that intelligent design could perhaps make its way into school systems across the country, or is this pretty much in the same place that it's been?
Well, there have been overtures in the public schools to look at the data, especially on origins, and challenge what is being published in the biology textbooks. Because the biology textbooks on the origin of life are giving speculations based on a natural phenomena, and the natural phenomena is not helping them. So they talk about the early Earth and how monomers emerged, just simple molecules. It's a speculation of what would have to happen in order for evolution to occur. Then they have multiple hypotheses. I'm looking at my textbook as I speak. And I have the three main hypotheses in the textbooks. This is the college textbook that says how life might have started on this planet. And all of the verbs are it might have happened, it could have happened, it suggests, another one, it could have, it's possible, some might have been more capable than others, there was might have had a selective advantage. So the verbs are might have, could have, should have, seems to, must have. And there isn't one solid verb in the entire chapter because no one can even fathom how non-life could become life. Mm-hmm. So with that kind of scientific non-information, but the schools K through 12 have to teach a little bit more every year, right up until you're a senior in high school, of how nature might have done it, based on no information from science. So why are we teaching something that has no chance of happening? Well, because the alternative is unthinkable, as one evolutionist said. I have to believe in evolution because the alternative, I see, above nature, the alternative is unthinkable. So we must teach this because the alternative would be saying you were created. See, mm-hmm. Now, in Kansas, the Kansas State Board of Education challenged many members of the board, not all of them, challenged the paradigm of we're teaching this kind of natural origins from rock to rock stars, as a friend of mine once put it, that we're challenging that non-life can make life based on these scenarios in the textbook that certainly can't work. But we have to teach that and nothing else. Well, what if there's data, they ask, what if there's data to suggest that these things can't happen? Then we shouldn't be teaching that. We might have to teach that we don't know how we started here naturally. Aha, well, there's some data. The data says we haven't a clue. But we can't say that because then kids might think that we got here some other way than nature. See, we can't let them have a thought, a real discussion about origins. We have to indoctrinate them. So the Intelligent Design Organization challenged that at the state board level. And I and 23 others from around the country testified there in 2005. And all we did was show the data that says there is no information whatsoever about non-life elements ever becoming life. It's and everything that has been tried in a test tube in laboratories fails miserably because you have to have all of it there, all the proteins and carbohydrates and lipids and nucleic acids, all the complex molecules have to all be there working together under proper control. So after all that testimony, the Kansas Citizens for Science, which is the atheistic evolutionary camp, was allowed 2 weeks to bring in all the experts they wanted to refute anything we said. But all we said was right out of the data, right out of the research. So they'd have to be refuting all of the research. Well, they decided that there was nothing they could refute. So they boycotted. And they told the media, and I was reading this in the newspaper when I was down there testifying, they told the media, this group just wants to teach religion in the schools. That was their rebuttal. So they had no data. So the State Board of Education in Kansas then changed the wording in their mandate of how to teach science K through 12 so that if you had data that refuted some of the claims of the textbook, you could teach that as long as it had data from a journal that was a juried and refereed journal. Gee, like real science, perhaps. And they passed that. And that stayed on the books for the next 2 years. Within those 2 years, the Kansas Citizens for Science managed to get some of their people elected into the State Board of Education. And 2 years later, they voted to rescind all that language that would have opened up origins to actual investigation. And now you have to teach the textbook. I love it. Life on planet Earth.
You know, there have been some recent high-profile comments in more progressive evangelical circles to the effect that Genesis is more poetry, it's more symbolism, and it's much more that than a reliable story about how life begins. And what would be your response to that?
From Watson and Crick fame, who first discovered the spiral DNA helix, Francis Crick wrote in the late 1990s, after studying DNA for 50 years, he said, it is being the most complex molecule on the planet. He said, it should not even be on this planet yet. If the planet is of life, if the life on this planet is 3.5-4 billion years old, is the estimate on the naturalism scale, DNA shouldn't even be here yet. Much, he says, but here we are. Not just DNA showing up, but gee, look at us. You know, this fantastic human creature is here. So then he finished by saying, perhaps the DNA was seeded here by aliens. Yeah. So you go, wow, here's our preeminent atheistic evolutionist DNA geneticist, and he can't figure out how DNA gets here, so you boot it off into the universe. It bothers me in science that when scientists can't figure something out, you just make up a story, but it better be nature, So you hobble. You actually are tying up science when you say this is the only way you can look at science. You can only look at it through the eyes of a natural process because we will not entertain anything else. So when churches try to get on the bandwagon to be accepted by a naturalistic society, I think that's the death knell of that church.
Dr. Bruce Simad has kindly joined us on the road. And Doctor, we do want to let you go. As people listen to you, they can tell you are a bright guy. I mean, you know your stuff. You've done your research. And yet, of course, as we've talked about throughout the interview, when a naturalist would talk about intelligent design and someone like you who ascribes to it, they would, hopefully they'd be kind to you and hopefully they'd be, you know, have a discussion with you that was effective and efficient, but they might tease you a little bit. Does it bother you at all to be in that position?
Well, I stand on the data. I have watched debates on tape and YouTube and et cetera. Of atheists debating Christians and debating, shall we say, theists even, just that there must be a God who did this versus there can't be a God, right? And and it turns out to be a bashing thing. The atheist does not have data to stand on, so they start to call names. Mm-hmm. All right, one is, you must have checked your brain at the door to not believe in evolution. See, well, there you go. At least my creator is intelligent, and their creator is sheer dumb luck from a rock. All right, somebody's got a problem here. So it's easy to debate this when you look at the data. All the name calling and everything else is a cover up and a sham when they don't have something to say intelligently.
Well said. Well, sir, thank you once again for your time, and I think a lot of people are really going to enjoy hearing about these things. It's something that's central to our faith, and I thank you very much. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the offer to come and talk.
Thanks for sharing in the story of this latest episode of Faith Radio's On the Road. For more on today's conversation and the full podcast archive of all our episodes, look for On the Road when you visit myfaithradio.com.